Welcome to the fifth Christmas special of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast.
Oh, gosh.
I'm filmmaker Richard DiGregorio.
And I'm film watcher Greg Ralph.
Ho, ho, ho.
Ho, ho.
So being our fifth Christmas special, can you believe it, Greg?
Actually, no. You know, I can't. I really can't.
Yeah.
Full stop.
Okay, so we are obviously every Christmas we've been doing one of these Christmas specials, and so this year we're going to be looking at three films.
Well, actually, a bit more than that this time, yeah. Ricardo. So this is our lead in to our next season next year,
season four.
Stop. So we're going to try something new next time around. So normally we have the theme that's around an episode. Sometimes
that's right.
Very, very forced, but, you know, we do. And we're going to try it maybe as a one-off for next season, have a seasonal theme as opposed to Christmas seasonal themes. And so what we thought we'd do is we're going to play with this word or this concept of extras.
That's right.
Extras has a lot of different meanings, and we'll unpack that next year. But for now, we're doing four films. We're doing an extra film, and we're doing an extra feast. The holiday. So we're actually going to do three Christmas films.
That's right.
And we're going to touch on one sort of Christmassy New Year's film.
Yeah. So the first one we're looking at is Santa Conquers the Martians.
Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Santa Claus Conquers the
Martians. A work of such art really deserves its full title, I think. From 1964, yes.
That's right. The second film we're looking at is The Grinch.
Well,
it's How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Because there's at least three Grinch films now.
That's right. So that's the 2000 film starring Jim Carrey.
Yep. And then we're going to do the 2003 Japanese anime film called Tokyo Godfathers.
And then there is the short film Dinner for One, the 1963 short.
It's really a TV kind of special, but we're going to touch TV very, very occasionally.
That's right.
In the spirit of Christmas, because you know, for me, our Christmas show is like Propsville.
Yeah.
So
it is.
I brought a couple of things this time.
Oh, no. What did you bring this time?
I brought us a little Christmas pudding each.
Oh,
In a pop top, whatever it is.
Yeah, nice.
Now, I've also been reading, by the way, just in the break that we've had, I've been reading about this new fad called ASMR.
What's
you heard of that?
No.
Autonomous Sensory Meridian Response. That's that thing where people get really close to the microphone and talk and have sound effects that are meant to send chills up your spine.
Yeah, right.
I think it kind of works like this, and then we bring the sound really close.
It's really actually
can you hard. Do, I can't open mine. Can you do yours?
Hang on. I'm using my teeth.
Yeah, ditto.
It's actually very difficult. You've chosen the worst ones. Hang on.
Well, this one's had no peel in it to speak of. I don't like
hang
peel.
Hang on.
Ricardo is opening his pudding.
Okay.
Right.
Oh, jeepers, creepers. This is really tough. Hang on.
Jinkies. That'll
there
do.
We go.
All right. Okay. So
after all that.
You going to do our first film?
Yeah, let's do our first film. Greg, are you eating?
Mm.
You're actually eating the pudding.
Are we ready?
Okay. Greg is eating the pudding, so he actually can't do the first film for tonight. Okay. But Greg is going to actually lead you in. He will, with a mouthful of pudding. Tell us about Santa Conquers the Martians. Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Okay.
Merry Christmas.
Well, that's a wonderful film. Not evil. Okay, I'll do it for real. I'm a good boy now. Okay, Santa.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Okay, so speaking of Santa.
Go for it.
Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
Wow.
So from the bad cartoon and the earworm song opening of this 1964 film, you know what you're in for. It's like a bad episode of its sci-fi contemporary Lost in Space. The story, in a nutshell, is the Martians are concerned that their children are suffering from a lack of childhood and Santa, aggravated by watching too much Earth TV, and I totally get that. The obvious solution is to kidnap Earth Santa. So after kidnapping two children to help them pick the real Santa out from the crowd of seasonal fill-ins, the Martians take all three back to Mars so that no one can blab about what they did. Despite the fact that they've left a host of witnesses at the North Pole who are obviously well connected with the American TV networks. Santa willingly cooperates in the building of a Martian toy factory, even though his main task seems to be pressing a button. But things are livened up by various attempts to kill the Earth trio, engineered by bad guy Martian, Voldar, Vincent Beck, whose heavy moustache probably deserves co-star billing. And eventually everyone goes home. This is a pretty dreary film that regularly makes lists Yeah. I know we both watched it. It regularly makes lists of all-time worst films. And sadly for me, though, it doesn't fall into the category of so bad it's good. I constantly battled sleep, and not because I thought Santa was coming. My 15-year-old son still resents me for making him watch it. And our newish TV mysteriously turned off after the thrilling attacks of a killer robot and a polar bear, and we thought, or perhaps hoped, that this was some quality control feature in the telly. There are clumsily choreographed fight sequences and a lot of newsreel filler footage to bog things down in the search for credibility. Although, interestingly, one sequence of a plane's mid-air refueling also featured in Dr. Strangelove. In fact, the film is most notable for its historical curiosities. It features an 8-year-old Pia Zadora as the Martian girl. Nice. It was filmed in the hangar used by Charles Lindbergh to store his Spirit of St. Louis plane the night before his famous transatlantic flight. There are period jokes about Nixon and the Russian space program, and the polar bear actor, Gene Lindsay, went on to feature in Watergate film All the President's Men. This is apparently the first time that Mrs. Claus ever featured in a motion picture, beating TV special Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer by 3 weeks. Look, the best aspects of this film are the sing-along lyrics for Hooray for Santa Claus in the end credits, on the start credits.
Oh, yeah.
But by the end, you're so browbeaten that you can't help but join in. And the casting of John Call as Santa, he is so Santa-like.
He is.
It's just a pity he wasn't given something more memorable to work with. So, Ricardo, have I gone too bar humbug?
No, you haven't, really. No, you haven't. Okay. I watched this with my son as well.
Who's nine?
Who's nine. His response to it was, it was funny, goofy, hokey, and really, really fake.
How does a 9-year-old know a word like hokey?
Yeah.
Is he a real child?
Yeah, he said that. Now, I'll tell you, you don't have to pay for this movie to watch it.
No.
You could.
Yay.
So I'd watch it. Just go out, just watch it on Tubi, which is T-U-B-I. It's an app. It's a free streaming app. It's got old movies on it and whatnot. Watch it on that because you don't want to pay for it. Look, it's really, really bad. Everything is bad about this movie. The screenplay, the makeup. The makeup is half done.
It seems to change. Sometimes they're green, sometimes they're black, smudgy.
Weird. But the thing is, it's like the worst. But if someone was to put... I've seen so much better face painting at a carnival.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they're half done it around the face and then the neck they've just not bothered with the green Martians.
Speaking of necks, did you notice the polar bear?
The polar bear?
So this guy in a suit, a bad polar bear suit.
The polar bear
After the killer robot that's made of toilet tubes and whatever else.
The killer robot is extremely bad, but the polar bear... It looks shocking. And the kid's reaction to the polar bear as it's trying to get them, they're just looking at it going...
It's really stupid.
They're not even scared.
But did you notice the neck?
No, I didn't notice the neck.
I went back to watch that scene. I only noticed the second time around, right? So the little boy and girl, 10, whatever they are, years old, they're both in this kind of ice cavern while the polar bear's trying to scrabble inside to get
bad.
Them. And there's a shot from inside looking at the polar bear as though you were the kids. And you can see the join. You can see the actor's neck between the joins of the head and the body. It's criminal.
There's, I love Ed Wood films, Plan 9 from Outer Space, because, you see a bit of the sets here and there and they move a little bit. But you know what? That is so bad it's good territory, because I still don't mind the way that those stories are told. This is the worst of the worst. Like, I haven't seen this bad for a while. The dialogue, I think one of them...
Check the radar box. Are you a television set?
Yeah, who's the guy that plays the meanie, the guy who's the mean Martian, the one with the moustache, which is obviously the fakest moustache.
Vincent Beck.
Oh, so bad.
Who went on to become president of the New York section of the Screen Actors Guild.
You've got to be kidding me. No. Oh, my God, this would have been you wouldn't want this on your CV.
He actually was in an episode of Lost in Space.
You wouldn't want this on your CV. Really, you wouldn't.
Yeah. No.
What are those funny things sticking out of your head? Those are antennae. Are you a television set? This is some of the dialogue. What's this one? What's soft and round and you put it on a stick and you toast it in a fire and it's green? I don't know what. A marshmallow.
And everyone laughs hysterically.
Exactly. A marshmallow. What about this one? Look, another one here. I will stop by the way. But I just want to
No, no, please don't.
That's right. What is this strange-looking creature over here? Oh, Winky made that. That's his idea of a Martian. A Martian? Wow-wee! Wow! I'd hate to meet a creature like that on a dark night.
How about... You haven't mentioned the ancient sage, Kokem?
No.
The guy who appears in the puff of smoke and has got the star.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a bad Gandalf.
Yeah, that's right.
He's saying, I've been predicting this for many centuries, that our children are not children. They get their heads filled with, like, digital stuff or something have no childhood. And
the Martians feed their kids pills.
Yeah, but pills that are named exactly the same as American Earth food. So apple pie, I think chocolate ice cream, whatever they were. And it's like, what do you do with that?
But also the fight sequences in it.
Oh, they were so clumsy.
Are so badly done. You've got to seem to be believed, this movie. You've got to watch it just to see how bad it really is.
You can
is.
Kind of excuse... So when the two Martians have the fight in the spaceship, mm-hmm. you can kind of excuse the fact that it's a bit clumsy. But in the climactic attack of the toys...
Oh, my
goodness.
Where
the bad guys have been attacked by little wooden soldiers and squirt guns or something as well. And it's just... It's woeful.
And what's his name? Vince Beck?
Yep.
Vincent Beck. Just sitting there while he's the bad guy. He's getting pelted by just soft toys, guns and stuff.
In his defence, I mean, he's pretty defenceless because he's wearing, like, Speedos and tights.
He is.
You see somebody in credits got credit for designing the Martian furniture?
No, you've got to be kidding me. And Bill McCutcheon as Droppo?
Yes.
It's like this comic relief character who is so over the top. It's excruciating. It's excruciating to watch.
So this film was all but forgotten and you know, deservedly so, until apparently the 90s when it got picked up in that comedy series out of America called Mystery Science Theater 3000, where they show old hokey, usually sci-fi films, and they had these kind of little silhouettes of the main characters doing acerbic commentary on it. I watched bits of it. I was actually bored by that as well. But it really raised its profile. And I wondered, I don't want to overstate this, but I wondered if maybe some things since have paid homage to it. So there's this animated film called Mars Needs Moms. Have you ever seen that?
No.
So similar kind of idea. The Martians come to kidnap the mothers from Earth because the children need better care.
Right, like, okay.
You know, TLC kind of stuff. So I wondered if maybe that was sourced from that. But I have to say, and I think here I'm drawing a long bow, but the scene where the robot... breaks into Santa's workshop.
Yes.
And they're defending themselves. Reminded me a little bit of the opening of Scrooged, you know, this.
Oh, yeah.
Which we did
Bill Murray,
in season one.
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
Remember there was that TV special being advertised with Lee Majors rescuing Santa?
Yes, yes.
It reminded me a bit of that. And I did love the conceit of this killer robot comes into Santa's workshop to kidnap him and then suddenly decides it's a toy.
That's right, exactly. Well, the thing
that was that was clever.
That was clever. Look, the actual story here, as I was watching it, I was just thinking, the actual story here could be remade actually quite well. I think the main problems with this is the... because I think it's actually quite a fun story, you know, but the effects, the performances, the screenwriting in every department, really, of this film failed miserably. So I think that makes it bad, but the actual story itself could be remade into like an animated cartoon or something like that. It could be.
Well, it's funny you should say that because there's kind of a connection between this film and our next film, How the Grinch Stole Christmas.
Mm.
And because there were rumours going back 20 years that this would be remade. And the original rumour was that it was going to be remade by David Zucker of Flying High fame.
Oh, right.
With Jim Carrey as Droppo.
Wow, okay.
And they said they were going to release it perhaps in 2002, and then the film kind of, you know, slipped into development hell. There's since been theatrical productions of this, including musicals.
Do you know what? I actually think it would work theatrically as a panto or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it would really work on stage because as I was watching it...
And celebrating its kind of, you know, awkwardness.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I think it would work on stage because the film is very much like you're watching a theatre show. They're acting the same way, but... if you were watching it on stage, I think it would be better and you would actually enjoy it a lot more. But because it's a film and it's so badly done, it just doesn't work at all.
We haven't mentioned one of my favourite parts. So I think the absolute highlight is the polar bear attack.
My favourite. It's interesting I say my favourite. It was it was hilarious.
But I am quite partial to the nuclear curtain. Do you remember that?
Which part was the nuclear explosion?
So when the bad guys were hiding out in the Martian caves,
yes,
and they had this kind of force field thing to stop people getting in or out, if you went through it, you'd get vaporized or something.
Yeah, that's right.
The nuclear curtain. So they had this little kind of, you know, cardboard boxy control panel thing. And when they turned it on, no sound effect, no special effect, no kind of, you know, 1960s version of lasers or something. You were just told that it was on and then it was off. And apart from just, you know, the poverty of the production, I was thinking, well, what a stupid thing. Because if you don't know it's on, there's no signal, and you walk into it as someone who's with the bad guys and you get vaporized. I mean, how stupid is that?
I really don't know how they finished that film and thought, we've got a really good movie on our hands.
Yes, well, anyway, this film, you know, came out for Christmas 64, and in June 66, one of the key people behind the film was boasting about the fact that they'd made 15 family-type pictures in 18 months, and I think that says everything.
Oh, that says a lot. I mean, really, I mean, what did they shoot this over 2 weeks, was it?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that shows.
Kind of shows.
Yeah, it does show. It does show. So Greg, what are you going to give Santa Claus Conquers the Martians?
Well, I'm going to give this a very generous 2 out of 10.
Wow.
Which for me, and I'm sorry about this, puts it firmly halfway between Showgirls and Cabaret.
Oh, okay. We can't go there. Oh, my
Please
goodness.
Don't. No. And your score?
1 out of 10.
1?
1. It's my first 1 out of 10. I don't think I've had a 1 out of 10.
Yeah, I did say 2 was generous.
Yeah, I could not possibly give it more than that. I mean, and that 1 is purely that I think the story could possibly be good in an animated movie now or something. But it's just, on every front, it just fails miserably. They could have done so much better.
The tragedy of this film is that it's not so bad it's good.
No.
Because the pacing is so leaden.
Yeah.
If it had been like Plan 9 from Outer Space, you know, Ed Wood's film, where things are constantly happening.
Yes.
But you get all this filler stuff that just
bad.
Really bogs it down.
Yeah, it's bad. It's just literally
bad.
Bad. But one thing which I think it fails mostly on was it just doesn't make me feel Christmassy. You know, that Christmas spirit you always long for?
It's well, only Santa because, does. He's a great Santa.
He's a very good Santa, but I still didn't at the end go, God, it's Christmas. How wonderful.
Did you sing along at the credits?
Hooray for Santa Claus.
Did you?
Well,
that's
no.
Why. If you only opened up your heart to the spirit of the film and the song. No, I can't even say that.
Oh, goodness.
Well, look, while we're in bar humbug mode, would you like to tell us about that modern Ebenezer Scrooge,
yes.
The Grinch?
Yes. Directed by acclaimed director Ron Howard, this year 2000 film, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, based on Dr. Seuss's classic book, begins on a tiny snowflake floating through midair. As we move closer and closer inside the snowflake, the town of Whoville exists, home of the Whos, who are joyously preparing for Christmas. They all love Christmas, but there is one exception.
Oh, who?
The Grinch, Jim Carrey, a grumpy recluse who simply hates everything to do with it. He even dislikes the Whos, who also feel the same way about him. In comes a young girl, Cindy, Taylor Momsen, who feels that Christmas has become too much about presents and less about family connection. When she spots the Grinch causing havoc at a post office, Cindy falls into a sorting machine and he rescues her, which prompts her to do a little more research into the grumpy Grinch. From the information she collects, the Grinch actually liked Christmas as a child and even had a crush on Martha May Hoover, one of the prettiest girls in his school. However, the current mayor, as a child, taunted the Grinch about this. The Grinch tries to create a handmade present for Margaret and shave off his facial hair, but the bad shaving job causes the class to laugh at him, finally causing him to hate Christmas. He runs away to live at the top of Mount Crumpet, north of Whoville, for the next 53 years. Touched by his story, Cindy decides to nominate the Grinch to be the town's holiday cheermeister. Much to the mayor's dismay, and the Grinch eventually accepts. Though as cheermeister, the Grinch is reminded of his childhood humiliation and begins to then berate the Whos for their materialism, telling them that Christmas is only about presents that will only end up dumped on Mount Crumpet near his home. So he plans to destroy the Christmas spirit by stealing all of their presents, decorations, and food while they're sleeping, disguising himself as Santa with his dog Max as a reindeer. This horrifies the town of Whoville, however, does not trample their Christmas spirit, and the Grinch soon comes to realise that the Whos treasure the Christmas spirit more than just presents, and his actions did not stop Christmas at all. Look, this is a fun film. It actually looks a little dated now, but its sets and costumes and the makeup for the characters, which won an Academy Award, really bring the world of Whoville to life. It's really refreshing to see a film that doesn't rely too heavily on CGI, computer-generated images. Obviously, more has been added to the Grinch story here to expand it to feature-length film, and I feel the story aspect would be a little boring at times if not for the brilliant performance of Jim Carrey. He's on top form here. He makes the film entirely. You can just see that Ron Howard just let him play with this character and just let the camera keep rolling, particularly in the scenes by himself. Scenes without him really stand out and are at times a little boring. However, the cinematography is colourful, Christmassy and bright. Ron Howard's direction has been visually better in other films he's made. Here it feels a little bit TV movie sometimes. However, in the end it succeeds in bringing all the Christmas tingle feels you expect, and in the end is essentially a story about finding joy after going through hardship. Greg, what did you think about it?
It's interesting. So there are now three versions of this film. There's the one, the TV special made, I think, in the 60s or 70s.
Yeah, that's right.
There's this version, and there's the 2018 version that's, you know, Minion-style animation.
That's right,
With Benedict Cumberbatch as the Grinch. I'm not sure I've seen the original TV one, but I've certainly seen the other two.
This is the only version I've seen.
And what's interesting about those two latter versions is they feel the need to delve into the Grinch's backstory to give him a reason.
Mm-hmm.
So you pointed out in this film, it's about, you know, the love affair that gets thwarted.
Yes.
In the more recent one, it's about the little boy who I think was in some kind of orphanage,
right,
and never had Christmas and was left out when other kids got it. Yeah, they've got to expand that. I don't know that the story really needs it.
Mm.
I think it works much more in this version than the other one.
Mm.
It's enough, I think, that he's, you know, as Dr. Zeus said, you know, have we mentioned this is his book?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
that, you know, just the fact that his heart was three sizes too small was enough of an explanation.
That's
but
right.
It's a longer story format. I get that.
It's interesting because the Dr. Seuss movies that have been made, I love the Lorax story.
Yep.
And they expanded that in the movie, and that really doesn't need expanding. It's completely, you know, transparent. You can see exactly what's going on in that book. That it doesn't need the songs and dances, you know, in the movie.
This is the first Dr. Zeus movie that was made. So Theodore Heisel, who was Dr. Zeus, had died. His widow, Audrey, had indicated that she was prepared to have films made in the right situation. And a number of people had pitched to her beforehand, including, I think, Ron Howard's co-producer.
But Ryan Grazier.
Ron Howard came to the party and what he pitched was that he thought that they needed to build up the character of Cindy Lou, the little girl.
Yes.
And
great idea.
And I think Audrey Geisel had also said that, you know, her dream casting was one of three people, one of which was Jim Carrey.
Mm.
And you're right, Jim Carrey is made for this part.
He is.
But I'm not as swung towards his performance as it sounds like you were. So he seems to veer between being the Grinch, who's like a real character.
That's right.
And excess Jim Carrey, which is when I don't like him. And we've talked about this before when we talked about The Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Yes.
When he is the Grinch, I think he's superb. And the moment of his conversion, when he's taken all of the Christmas paraphernalia and about to dump it over the cliff, and he looks down into the town and he sees the Whos holding hands and singing and still celebrating Christmas.
That's right.
As the sun rises, which is, you know, a symbol.
Mm-hmm.
But under those layers of makeup, Carrey makes you believe that he's having a genuine conversion.
Yeah,
that his heart has grown.
Yeah.
You absolutely believe it. In that moment, he makes the film.
Yeah, and under all that makeup, I mean, that would have been absolutely uncomfortable.
Whereas in the 2018 film, it's just a moment. And it, I know it's animated, so it's different, but it still has to work.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work.
Mm.
And I think it's a much weaker film on a number of levels. But this one, when Carrey is showing the heart of the character, not just the manic kind of stuff, is when I think he just shines.
Yeah, and I think that's the kind of actor he is, though.
Oh, yes.
You know, he has so many layers underneath that extrovert persona he puts out there. He can turn the feels on very quickly. like he seems to be quite an introvert in real life.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice who the narrator was?
Yes, that was Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, that was a nice touch.
I picked that voice, yeah. I could pick that voice anywhere.
I think I read it in the title.
Did you? No, I picked the voice straight away. It's like, it's to me, that voice is like Morgan Freeman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think an unusual claim to fame for this film also is I would never have matched as a romantic couple in my life Jim Carrey and Christine Baranski.
Yeah, never. It's no, like, that's right. Exactly.
I think it kind of works. It's a very weird setting.
Yeah, but I love that. She's great, actually.
I like her in lots of things. Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
And I think she gets better as she goes along.
Mm.
But when it opens, so when you get the opening scenes going through Whoville and everyone madly rush around shopping and sort of colourful chaos and celebration, as I was watching, I was thinking, yeah, this is Hollywood at its best. You know, it's an elaborate set, but it's real.
It's real.
The makeup is superb. So you didn't actually say it was Rick Baker who did American Werewolf in London,
but and so many others. Did the
I Nutty
he, Professor?
Did he do Thriller as well?
Yeah,
I think
he's done so much.
Yeah. And the makeup is, you know, it took a long time to apply. When Jim Carrey first was doing it, it took 8 hours to apply.
Yeah,
and he had a bit of a hissy fit, and they had to cut it down how they were doing it.
That surprised me. Apparently, the contact lenses really hurt him. The contact lenses in the eyes really hurt him. Yeah,
but the opening reminded me of the Munchkins in The Wizard of Oz.
Oh yes, I can see that.
And that grand scale Hollywood. And the physicality of it in a way you don't see anymore.
Yeah, I could see why that.
I watched recently a French film that came out a couple of years ago, depending on the English or the French name, it's Santa and Co. or Christmas and Co. And the start of the film is really great. It's all CGI, but it's showing Santa's workshop from a non-American perspective, and it's really great. But it's technically impressive and visually impressive, but it's not engaging because, again, it's not real. This feels real.
It does, and that's the charm of it.
And did you see who the film was dedicated to?
Oh, it was a family member of Ron Howard.
His mother. It was dedicated to Jean Spiegel Howard, who died, I think, somewhere between the making of the film and its release.
Right.
And it was dedicated to her as the one who loved Christmas the most. Her whole family was in the film. So, one way or another. So, Ron was directing.
Yes.
Clint, who he often uses in his film, played the mayor's sidekick.
Oh, right.
That was Ron Howard's brother, yeah. His father, Rance Howard, was the elderly timekeeper who was saying "How long till Christmas?"
Oh, okay.
And apparently, Bryce Dallas Howard is in it.
Yeah, really?
I didn't spot her. I have to say, I read about this one. She plays a character called the Surprised Who. And I worked out from the time, and she must have been sort of either side of 10 years old.
Yeah.
So I don't know which character she actually is, but she's in there as well.
I really
well.
Like Bryce. I think
well,
Bryce.
We both do.
Yeah.
The other thing about Jean Spiegel Howard, and you know, I like to build connections between films.
Mm-hmm.
She was in Scrooged.
Where?
She was Mrs. Claus in the Lee Major special at the start when the workshop gets attacked. Yeah. And so it's twice now I mentioned that scene.
Yeah, well, there we go. In Scrooge.
Can I make it connect with every movie?
And I didn't like Scrooge that much.
I know you
didn't, that's right.
But you know I do.
Mm.
The other interesting thing about this film is it was the sixth highest grossing film of 2000.
Yeah,
and you can see why.
I remember it was a very big success.
And for many, many years, it was the second highest grossing holiday film of all time behind Home Alone. But both movies got pipped last year by the remake of Grinch, which I don't think is that great a film at all.
Yeah, I haven't seen it.
And my younger son was bored by that.
Due to the computer animated nature of it, I'm not really that interested. But what are you going to give this one?
I'm giving this a 7.
Yeah, snap.
Yeah, it's a little dated, but that's not why I'm giving it a 7. It's because I certainly think it walks all over the more recent one. I don't like Jim Carrey's histrionics. That's where he loses me.
See, I don't have a problem with that at all. I think
I think
he really, I mean, he did the same sort of thing with the Riddler in Batman Forever.
Yes.
And, you know, he was allowed to play in that. And I think he did a great job as the Riddler as well for that.
Actually, I agree.
Yeah. He does a very similar thing with this character, but he is the Grinch. He is.
So why is it a 7 and not higher for you?
I just don't think it's a bit dated. And like I said, if it wasn't for Jim Carrey, I think I would have been a little bit bored.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, sometimes a performance is so good that, you know, it actually makes the film better. I find that with the Dark Knight. We're going into Batman territory again, but Heath Ledger's performance, I think, made that movie. And if it wasn't for his performance being so good, I think that would have fallen a little bit shorter than what everybody thinks it is. And I think this film is a bit the same. I think Carrey makes it, and you know, without his performance, I don't think it would have been as amazing.
It would be lower than 7 for me if it wasn't for that moment, that conversion moment that just worked.
It works. Yeah, and that's a major moment, though.
It is.
That is a major moment,
but
which they
works.
Made
they ha-
work.
It has to work.
Yeah, it has to.
Or the story, but, well, I'd just say it becomes unbelievable. I mean, it's obviously fantasy, yeah, but right. it wouldn't ring true.
Yeah.
So one more thing, because I watched the making of little extra on my DVD.
Right.
And here we are talking about extras again, another
yes,
form of
okay,
extras.
Yes, great.
Yep. Do you know who's doing a lot of the Whoville performances? You know, the people of the town?
Who was that?
Cirque du Soleil.
Really?
They did a lot of prep stuff with, you know, trampolinists and gymnasts and...
Makes sense.
And so, yeah. And again, it's that physicality of the show.
Yes. And again, this is a movie and they're doing that, whereas Santa Conquers the Martians, you know, it's very staged and theatrical. So the third Christmas film we are going to discuss this episode is 2003's film Tokyo Godfathers. Greg, tell us about this one.
I shall. It's Christmas Eve in Tokyo. Although you might not believe it, as it's the only one of our Christmas movies where you don't see Santa or the baby Jesus.
Mm.
But we get the next best thing to the baby Jesus in this 2003 Japanese anime film from Satoshi Kon, a newborn baby found in the back alley garbage equivalent of a manger. The three homeless people who find her, and yes, it's a baby girl this time, are a quarrelsome trio. Miyuki, voiced by Aya Okamoto, an angsty preteen girl. Jin, voiced by Yoshiaki Umagaki, an alcoholic who likes to gamble. And Hana, voiced by Toru Emori, a melodramatic ex-drag queen, transsexual or transvestite, I'm not entirely clear which. But together, they are a family, mum, dad and daughter, sharing a large box together in a park that's fitted out like an apartment. They name the baby Kyoko, meaning pure child, which apparently is the Japanese translation of Silent Night, due to her being found on Christmas Eve. They set out to restore baby Kyoko to her parents on a journey and plot, driven by wild coincidences and extraordinary events, such as a cross-dressing Latin American hitman, or an ambulance that appears out of nowhere to crash through the front of a convenience store. I couldn't understand why these three are called the Godfathers, since Miyuki, at least, is a girl. Apparently, it's a reference to John Ford's 1948 film, The Godfathers, where John Wayne and two other men rescue a baby from its dying mother on Christmas Eve. But to me, the film's central story seems to be a Christmas reference to the three wise men, except these three characters are on a journey during which they develop wisdom, based on an understanding of themselves and each other. I often enjoy animation of various kinds, and I grew up on a steady diet of comic graphic novels, but I have to say that this is not my style of animation, with its mix of detailed, realistic and exaggerated caricatures. And I got a little annoyed by the number of loose ends left in the story. I can admire the craft with which this film creates strong, believable characters and a recurring sense of place in a series of different settings. Most memorable for me was an early moment where, after a lot of loud interactions, there was still silence as Christmas snow fell on the city. And there were laugh-out-loud moments and charming acts of whimsy, including within the opening and closing credits. But in the end, I just don't think I'm this film's demographic. What about you, Ricardo?
Look, it's beautiful. It's also ugly.
Yes.
Gritty, and it's very stylized as well. And hopeful as well, all at once. So it's got a lot going on here. And the animation is wonderful, okay? But that's to be expected from Japanese anime. But again, it just looks like sort of most Japanese anime I've seen. So it's not, it doesn't sort of pose anything new.
Well, I'm not sure I've watched a lot of anime before. So the settings, I think, were standout. And I don't know how typical that is. I recognise some of the character styles.
Yeah.
But the settings were great.
But it was wonderful. Beautifully animated, absolutely. But you're right, it really plays on the Christmas theme of, you know, miracles.
Yep.
So the three characters are all very tortured souls looking for something special to come into their lives, and this baby is it, and it gives them purpose. And you're right, it's as if the three wise men found Jesus alone in the stables and they went looking for Mary and Joseph. That's pretty much what it
is. As you do.
As you do. But I didn't love it either. I'm with you. I liked it. I got a little bored at times and felt like it played on one note a lot of the time. Scenes felt like other scenes I'd already seen, and that's what sort of became a bit boring. And it was just too over melodramatic. Okay, I got tired of all the yelling and the crying. It's just so melodramatic.
And it's not a long film. It's pretty much an hour and a half.
Yeah, yeah, and I got a bit bored by it. I like how it brings to light the issues of the homeless people.
Yep.
Anywhere, not just in Tokyo. You know, they really showed us a lot in that regard. The, you know, them going into the, you know, getting lining up for food and the plight of the homeless people, and having a transgender woman as a main character was also very brave for the film, I think.
And you kind of forgot what gender they were at different points in the story. Yeah,
yeah. And it's really interesting that she was probably the most maternal out of anybody in the film. And the way she cares for baby Kyoko is really lovely. But I really got tired of all the gay jokes, though.
Mm-hmm.
I know the character Jin says most of them and they are linked to that character's persona, but it's like, come on, screenwriters. Did you not know what to write? So you thought, let's write another gay joke for Hannah. I mean, I really just got a bit over that. I was like, come on, I don't need to hear them do these just, you know, derogatory gay jokes toward this character when, you know, it's actually quite a lovely character. And you've actually created a really good character here.
A strong
character. And you just keep with these jokes, which aren't funny. I don't find them funny. But anyway.
I wondered if maybe there were some things lost in translation.
Possibly.
But again, it's too hard to tell.
Yeah, it is. But ultimately, yeah, I didn't love it. It didn't give me the Christmas spirit at all. I think the story was also very convoluted.
Yeah.
And, you know,
and I said there were too many loose ends. So not everything had to be, like, resolved happy ever after. But the hitman story.
Yes.
In particular, I wanted to know more about that. So why did he dress up as a maid to get close to his target? So why was he doing that? Was that personally driven? Was it a job? What happened with that character he tried to kill? What happened to the character who he actually seriously wounded?
That's right.
In the attack, the family, you meet his family. And that's actually quite a nice scene where they weren't talking the same language and yet the teenage girl and the hitman's wife bonded over the two babies.
That's right. Now That was a lovely moment. There's lovely moments.
So
like
you've actually put these people sort of at the heart of the story and we don't come back to them. And I think that was a real gap.
Yeah. It does.
And you know, we say this again and again and again. In the end, it comes back to story and characters. And if you don't have that, if it's not believable, if it doesn't work, it doesn't matter how beautiful, how great the graphics or CGI or performances, if you haven't got that, you're off to a really, really bad start.
But then we have this moment, which I'm not going to spoil this part of the movie, but there's a moment which sort of leads you into the third act and it becomes a bit more of a chasing, save the baby kind of a story, which I just didn't think it needed. I think it could have stopped there. They could have, you know, found what they needed to, and it could have been a really lovely
rescuing the baby when it went off the rooftop. Actually, I liked the execution of that.
Yeah, that was fine.
That really worked. Yes. But all the stuff leading up to
that, like, really, it's just,
I'm a bit the same about this film, actually.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you felt the same way, because I was watching it going, is it just me? I know it's beautiful animation, it takes a long time to do, but I was sitting there going, is it just me, or am I in the wrong mood to see this? I'm really not loving it.
You know, I haven't loved any of our Christmas movies this year, and I kind of feel the lack of that.
Mm. So what are you going to give this one?
It's a 6 for me.
Yeah, I'm giving it a 5.
I wanted to like it, even recognising it's not my genre. I wanted to like it, and I think it tells some important stories. The fact that homeless people at the centre of the story, although interesting narrative choice, all three of those were kind of homeless by choice. They all had homes to go back to.
That's right.
And felt they couldn't for different reasons. And I actually have no idea how true that or representative that is. But interesting that they were at the heart of the story. So I like that. But, yeah, it just didn't get there for me.
Again, if it doesn't connect with me and I'm not finding, you know, I'm not feeling for these characters at all. And, again, I just think it was just overly melodramatic and that just really got to me. It was irritating, actually. It was a little bit irritating as well.
Right.
So, yeah, that's why I give it a 5. And here we are. We've got our extra part of the episode tonight is a short film, Dinner for One. Greg, tell us a little bit about this one.
Okay, well, this 18-minute single-take black-and-white film was recorded in 1963 for a German TV station in English with a short German introduction. So if you were like me, Ricardo, you probably skipped the first 3 minutes where some guy was talking at you in German.
I actually looked for it on YouTube.
Which is where you can watch it, yeah.
Yeah, and I thought, oh, this is the wrong version. So I went through quite a few different versions on YouTube thinking, oh, my goodness, it's in German. What have you done to me, Greg?
Was it subtitled? I can't remember.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, it's just,
there was no subtitle. It's
I think
just
I was dancing around
German.
YouTube as well.
Yeah, and it just starts in German. I thought, what have you done to me, Greg? This is in German. There's no subtitles.
April Fool.
Yeah. I thought, is this a joke?
Well, I'm not sure if it's actually a Christmas or a New Year film, or it's probably a bit of each, but certainly watching it has become an annual Christmas New Year tradition across Germany, Northern Europe, Scandinavia, Australia here on SBS,
yeah,
and South Africa, although it's virtually unknown in the UK and the USA, which is interesting because it's British characters, British actors.
It is, yeah.
And apparently it's the most frequently repeated television program ever. It's essentially a one-joke comedy sketch set at the 90th birthday celebration of the aristocratic Miss Sophie, May Warden. It's an annual celebration attended by her four invisible, long-gone male friends, all toasting Miss Sophie through the impersonations of her butler, James, Freddie Frinton. The joke is that James becomes increasingly drunk as he drinks for each guest at each course. He becomes increasingly unable to walk while avoiding a tiger skin rug, to serve and pour, toast the birthday girl, and click his heels together in a German salute. Miss Sophie herself is putting away the booze and seems to eat little. While Freddie Frinton is the star of the show, May Warden is also good. This is a quaint piece. It's dated in its humour and execution, but there are still moments that made me laugh. I don't entirely understand its appeal beyond family tradition. But my wife was delighted when I put it on because it was a favourite of her mother. She tells me that she laughed at the time because her mum was laughing.
Mm.
And perhaps that's more than enough. Ricardo, what did you think?
I loved it. I thought this was hilarious. And so did my little boy as well, who watched it.
Yep.
And my wife as well. They both loved this film a lot. And I cracked up laughing at it. I think it's a really great little film. It is. It's one sketch. It really is. But, you know, you talk about May Warden.
Mm.
She's the straight...
Except for the punchline.
Except for the... Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Which is... which is very risque, but for the time, it's very risque. But without her playing it so straight, his comedy would not as be as amazing. But
there were a couple
so
of times,
good.
There were a couple of times when I thought she was suppressing a smile.
Yeah. Oh, it would not surprise me in the least. As he just keeps going round and round and getting progressively drunker and drunker, really, it's a joy to watch this little film.
Well, apparently the tiger skin rug, which he keeps tripping on the head off or very deliberately stepping around.
Yes.
But when they first started doing it as a live show, the tiger wasn't part of it. But they did a performance somewhere where this tiger skin rug was particularly beloved by the mayor or someone. And so they put it in and then he kind of was tripping over it. So it became a staple part of the story.
Yeah, isn't that wonderful? Probably happened in the rehearsal process.
Yeah, but I didn't love this as much as you did.
Really?
Now, I've seen it before, you haven't.
As a one gag 18-minute film, I think it's fantastic.
It's middleish for me. I mean, I enjoyed it. And the moment I loved is at one stage when he's going around the end of the table where she's sitting and he grabs the back of a chair for stability and she tips right back, almost completely head over heels. And I kind of gasped and laughed at that. I mean, there were moments for me that worked, but
I got a little bit tired of it,
but I have seen it before. And, you know, your second viewing, who knows?
It was my first view. I've only seen it once. That was that one time, and I was laughing all the way through it. We all were, actually.
Is this the film you enjoyed most, the most Christmassy one for you?
No, I think, man, the Grinch is still holds a lot of good Christmas feels to it. So, you know, that was a 7 out of 10. That was, you know, that was pretty a good Christmas film. This one here, but this is funny, and I'd say everybody should watch it. It's quite
free.
Funny. It's free. You'll go to YouTube and watch it on there, and don't worry about the German bit at the beginning. That does pass.
It's not subtitle. That's just bizarre.
Weird. It's a weird... I don't know why. But it's great. I'm giving it an 8 out of 10 on that one.
Wow.
Yeah, I think it's fantastic.
For me, it was a 5.
5?
Yeah.
No, I laughed. I had a ball with it.
No, just...
It's funny.
I find it a bit dated, a bit quaint.
Well, it is dated and quaint, but the joke, I just love that old school humour. I love it.
I'm curious to know now what my boys would make of it, because I just watched it with my wife.
Yeah.
And who had a memory of it. And she didn't love it either, actually. For her, it was more remembering with love how much her mother enjoyed it.
I see. We all laughed.
Well, I'm glad to have given you that Christmas gift.
That's right. So that concludes our Christmas special, our fifth Christmas special for the
Christmas
filmmaker.
Christmas New Year.
Christmas New Year special for the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast.
Now, you know, I like my little, you know, end of Christmassy, special effecty,
you do,
proppy thing.
Yes.
And I think I've excelled myself. I'm glad we're doing New Year's because I kind of run out of, stop ducking, because I run out of, like, jingle bells and Christmas crackers and so on. I tried to find a sound effect of like a New Year's Eve party, champagne popping and so on. What was out there was pretty pathetic. But I found this. I found these kind of confetti guns.
You don't point it towards me, Greg. Don't point them towards me.
I haven't pulled the trigger
yet. Don't point them towards me.
You've watched too many Midsummer Murders.
Yeah.
So we've both got these little kind of guns that shoot confetti out. A bit like a party popper. We think it probably makes rather a loud noise. So again, if you're driving, pull over. Pause the tape. pause us. Pull over.
The tape.
Lock the dogs in the laundry, whatever you need to do. And I'm going to try these things. And happy
okay,
new year. Ready?
Okay, ready? Happy
on the count
new year.
Of three.
I don't know what these are going to do. Okay. 1, 2, 3.
Oh, God.
Oh, jeepers.
Oh, my God. It's not confetti, it's glitter.
It's glitter.
Oh, the gunpowder is extraordinarily strong.
It is. That's
probably not the thing to do in an enclosed small studio, really, is it?
Really? With the vacuum.
You or not me. Yeah. So all care and glitter, no responsibility. That's my life philosophy. So
look,
here ended the Christmas episode.
That's right.
And our eardrums.
And we wish you a very Merry Christmas and a really safe and happy new year. Stay safe out there. We really look forward to...
In the new year, our season four.
Our season four.
With our extras theme.
That's right.
We think...
Yeah, you know, I think it's going to be wonderful, and I think it's going to be a really enjoyable season, and we can't wait to bring that to you in the new year. So have a safe and merry Christmas.
Enjoy the magic.
Yeah, and we'll see you next year in with season four.
Ta-ra. Ta-ra? Oh, that hurt.